The Pre-Paces podcast is brought to you by two brilliant sponsors. Paces Ahead is a fantastic four-day face-to-face Paces course run in Brentford, London. They bring you a whole host of patients with fascinating stories and reliable signs, and these patients are absolutely delighted to allow you to hone your exam skills prior to exam day. Some of the patients actually are used in the exams themselves, and the next courses are running from the 20th to the 23rd of May, and then I will be helping out on the course running on the 28th to the 31st of May. Please do come and say hello. I'd love to have a chat and hopefully help you on your way to passing your paces. But if you can't make the course for whatever reason, our other sponsor, Pass Test, has got you covered with their market-leading online revision resource. There are tons of videos which help you revise from the comfort of your own home, and most listeners that I've spoken to have said this is equally essential for your paces success. But that's enough for me for now. Let's get into this week's episode of the Pre-Paces podcast. Listeners, it's Sam here again, this time returning to your feeds with Dr. Dan Firmage, who you may remember from our recent episode on memory loss. Dan has examined over 1,000 PACES candidates, and what he doesn't know about maximising your PACES marks isn't worth knowing. We go through every single marking domain, what he's found as the biggest pitfalls, and ways that you can avoid them to make your exam experience as straightforward as possible. And the Buy Me a Coffee superheroes this week are James, Laura, Lauren, Catherine, and Holly, who all donated very close to their exam days. They were all extremely kind, and so I'm wishing you all the very best when it comes to your results. But if the news isn't good, the podcast will always be here for you to help you prepare for the next time around. Wishing you all the very best of luck. But for now, on with the show. Welcome, listeners, to the Pre-Paces podcast. I'm Dr. Sam Williams, and this week we are welcoming back a fantastic returning guest. That's right, we've got consultant geriatrician, IMT regional TPD, and MRCP Paces examiner, Dr. Dan Firmage. Dan, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Sam. Thank you for having me back.
Fantastic. And Dan, this week we're going to be covering something which is slightly different, but still very Paces related. We're not going to be tackling a Paces topic, so to speak, but after our last conversation, one thing that you mentioned to me is that there are a lot of PACES pitfalls which you find when you're examining PACES, and opportunities for candidates to slip up, potential banana skins. And this is hopefully going to arm our listeners with the tools to avoid some of these PACES pitfalls.
Yeah, I think I got my stats. I think I've examined nearly 1,000 people in PACES now, and the same things happen every time I go. And I want to try and help people by telling you some of the things that people commonly do that you can just not do that will hopefully avoid you losing marks, or sort of help you to get marks by doing things that, you know, simple stuff basically that people can do to improve their chances of getting full marks.
Wow, 1,000 candidates examined. So listeners, this is going to be an absolute barn burner. I can't wait. Let's get into the conversation on PACES pitfalls. So Dan, first of all, we're going to outline the domains under which they are marked. This is the sort of boring admin side of it, but this is really important because listeners will have to tick each box independently. We know that within each station, they are examined on these domains, and then each station has a variety of the domains, but some are not marked in some of them. For example, communication is not examined in the examination stations. And either way, some of these are going to be, I think for the clinical consultations, every single domain is marked. So this is going to be really, really important for our listeners to know exactly where they can pick up these marks and where they are liable to lose them. So first of all, we're just going to outline the seven skills tested. We've got skill A, physical examination, which makes up 14% of your mark. We've got skill B, identifying clinical signs, again, 14% of your mark. C, clinical consultation, slightly less, 10% of your mark. D is for differential diagnosis, again, 14%. E is clinical judgment, which is 19% of your marks, and more of your marks are given for your clinical judgment. Managing patient concerns is skill F, which is 10% of your mark, and skill G, maintaining patient's welfare, 19% of your mark. So those are our domains. And as we mentioned, the pass mark for each individual domain is slightly different. We are going to run through each skill and discuss where candidates might often fall down within each skill domain, and maybe pepper in some examples of practice which may land some candidates in trouble. So Dan, if we start off with physical examination, I've jotted down some thoughts, but I'm really excited to hear what you find are the most common pitfalls that listeners may fall into when performing physical examination. And so for our listeners, the physical examination, of course, will be examined in every examination station, as well as our clinical consultation stations, but importantly, not the communication station. So Dan, tell us your thoughts on physical examination.
So I'm going to divide this into the examination and then the consultation, because they're slightly different. But basically, the physical examination is marked completely separately to everything else and is purely your examination skills. So for the chest, cardiology, neurology, and abdominal stations, it's can you do a thorough systematic examination as you would have learned to do at medical school, not forgetting anything major, and doing it with good technique, basically. So generally, people do these quite well because we've all been taught the examinations years ago. However, there are still some things that people do that make them look a bit sloppy or make them do things that means they don't pick up the signs. So thinking about them, I guess, in kind of order of station, the first thing is to make sure that you try to expose the patient. So this is a bit more relevant in consultation, where the patient is probably going to be more dressed in the examination, but you've got to at least make an attempt to expose them adequately. If you listen through clothes or over clothes, or if you examine an abdomen through clothing, you'll automatically be scored unsatisfactory. And I've seen people hear crackles because they've listened through a woolly jumper, and I've seen people miss a large abdominal scar because they just sort of felt the abdomen. Those are both in consultation. But so thinking about the examination station, so respiratory examination, so inspection is done often extremely poorly. So the stand at the end of the bed, get the patient to cough. If they've got a loud, productive cough, that's going to put bronchiectasis right up your list of differentials. But so many people don't do that. Having a good, really having a look at the breathing, getting them to cough, and then inspecting the chest all round and have a good look everywhere. Often people come from the right, they'll have a good look under the right and around here, but they'll forget to look on the left-hand side. So that inspection is relevant for all of the examination stations, and people don't spend enough time on it, I would say. Not doing lymph node examination in respiratory, just doing that and everything else is fine, you're not going to fail. But if you do that and a few other things that they might add up. Doing anterior palp, there's a trend at the moment of people sort of gently tickling the lymph nodes from the front rather than sort of doing it with them sat up from behind. Again, if you just do that, you're not going to get marked down. But if you do that with other things, the examiner will start to think, does this person know how to examine? Chest expansion, people do very poorly. So, you really got to get your hands tight around the chest and get them to breathe in. If you just put your hands on the chest and then they breathe in, your hands aren't going to move anywhere. So a real grip around the chest is important. And then time management in respiratory is vital. So some people spend quite a long time, don't get to the chest before 3.5 minutes. And then what you need to get to is the auscultation, but you must remember to do the other stuff as well. So cardiology, a couple of key things that people don't do. So they do the JVP when the patient has got their head sort of bolt upright at 90 degrees. So you can't obviously assess the JVP. Forgetting to do the sitting forward and rolling to the left, aortic and mitral maneuvers. And particularly for mitral stuff, you really will miss stuff if you don't get people to move, to roll over to the left. Not missing permanent AF because they haven't focused when they were feeling the pulse or listening to the heart. And often the pulse may feel regular, but when you listen, you can hear that it's irregular. And then, as I say, often people miss murmurs and metallic valves because they're not doing the right maneuvers. And missing pacemakers and devices because you're not inspecting properly is a common thing as well. Abdomen, again, inspection, get the patient to cough is helpful. Lymph nodes are, again, missed commonly in abdominal examination. Loads of people forget to block the kidneys. And then if you've got polycystic kidney disease, then you'll miss that sign. People doing their shifting dullness. So often you do the first bit of tapping and you don't detect any dullness. And that's fine. You can stop there and say, I haven't detected any dullness, but people then insist on rolling the patient over. And if you're running out of time, then you're wasting your time, although you're not going to be marked down if you do that. And then neurological is a challenging one because you may be asked to assess different systems, inspection, look for wasting, you know, not assessing gait is important. If it's anything to do with lower limbs or unsteadiness or cerebellar, you've got to get them up and try and walk them at some point, whether you choose to do that at the beginning, because it can give you a lot of information, or whether you hedge your bets and try to do that at the end. People don't often know the core features of Parkinson's, so just be aware, bradycardia, rigidity, tremor, examine for those things, and then the additional Parkinson's plus. When you're testing power, kind of, you know, not isolating the muscle groups to make sure, you know, often people are testing the leg power, but they're actually getting power from the hips and the back because they haven't fixed it. People flap about sensation. At the end of the day, we know that you don't have a lot of time. If you pick one or two modalities of sensation and you do them properly, and you've chosen the ones you think are going to give you the best thing, we're not really that bothered if you don't do joint position sense or vibration sense. So, I mean, those are just a few bits that are very easy to tidy up and will hopefully give you more information, but are commonly kind of done, not brilliantly in the examination stations, but it's just about being systematic and thorough and doing the exam like you've done it millions of times in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've echoed some of the stuff which I had come up with. So examining over clothes is a big no-no, and I've seen people do that as well. Interesting, we have talked about what I've called the PACES examination blind spot before, which is that sort of left flank area. And we've talked about that in two of the episodes. We've talked about it in the lung surgery episode for posterolateral thoracotomies, which can hide around there, as well as nephrectomy scars. As Dan says, absolutely, making sure that, particularly paying attention to that left flank area, to make sure you are not missing those important signs, which could make or break your station.
I think being distracted. So one of the cases from this weekend was a lobectomy. So there was a large left-sided lobectomy with a few drain scars, but actually the guide also had a thoracostomy on the other side with it. There was a 4-centimeter scar in the right, but everyone saw the huge and completely missed. Not a single person picked up the one on the right. So just don't assume because you found one big sign that there's not something else there that might be relevant.
Yeah, fantastic. And just wanted to, if I can plug my wares again, is that for patients, or if you are one candidate or listener who's not clear on the signs of Parkinson's, head back on to episode 35. That is our episode on Parkinsonism. So go back and listen to that. Time pressure within a neuro station. You're preaching to the converted on that one, Dan. I think neurology is so difficult to cram in all of that, and tailoring your examination to the signs that you find as you go through is most important too. So you're leaving out as little as possible, but also leaving out the things which are going to add as little as is possible to your diagnosis or suspected diagnosis.
Though in the consultation, the good news is that you now have more time. And so examination, you used to have to really, really select out what are the one or two key things that I need to show that are important here, whereas now there's a little bit more time. So with the consultation, the same principles apply, but obviously the examinations are less rigid and systematic and a bit more day-to-day what we would normally do. I think the key things are, you need to think about, if you were presenting to me on a post-date ward round or in a clinic, what are those key things I need to have examined relevant to this presenting complaint that I would not look at you if you hadn't done and be a bit surprised about? I think you've got a little bit more time to be a bit more systematic, but you don't need to do a full neurological examination in a consultation. You need to pick which are the key bits. We mentioned kind of trying to expose the patient as much as possible, but that might be that you just slide the stethoscope up the back of the jumper and listen, you know, depending on what the patient is able to do. But it's for the consultation, it's really about picking out those core things that were likely to find you the signs based on the history that you've taken.
And so if we move on to skill B, so this is identifying physical signs, I should say. And the first thing I think, Dan, which won't be news to any listeners, but making up signs when they aren't there, I think is probably the biggest crime you can do in PACES. But I'm interested to hear what other pitfalls you've experienced in this domain, identifying physical signs.
So I mean, this is the skill that gets most commonly UK trained doctors because they just don't see enough patients and don't examine enough people, and the pathology is less here. So I think you're right. Number one is going to be you've got to get the core signs. And actually, I think if you watch examiners calibrate, you'll realize that we are much fairer than you think we are. So we have to examine the patient together without knowing what the patient has. Then we have to compare and agree. And if I say I can't hear the murmur that my examiner colleague will go back and have another listen, and if I still can't hear it, we wouldn't expect anyone to get it. Equally, if there's 15 signs, we're not going to expect. We will find what the core three or four main signs that people get. So you've got to get the core signs that we think are the vital ones. So that's important. You've got to find the signs that are there, and that's, you get that by being systematic and thorough. Missing signs will obviously get you an unsatisfactory or a borderline if there's one thing that you've missed. Making up signs is a real thing that people like to do. Often, if the patient's dropped out and you've got the F2 stepped in to do the abdominal examination, we had a guy who did it for us a couple of years ago, and he just had a big six pack, but people thought they could feel spleens and livers commonly, and obviously that is a no-go. So if you hedge your bets and say there's a minor sign, like, oh, I thought there was some palmar erythema, and it's not really that, then you're probably not going to get an unsatisfactory. But if you make up crackles, or you find a murmur that wasn't present, or you feel a mass in the abdomen, you'll get unsatisfactory for that. And that's usually because people haven't been thorough and taken their time over the examination. And then you've got to tell us what you found as well, because often you'll have felt the AF or you'll have seen the scar, but actually in your presentation you just forget to mention it. And most of us will try and say, is there anything else, or did you, what about on a palpation, did you, if we can't get it out of you, we can't get it out of you. And if we don't hear you tell us that what you found, then that's also a pitfall.
And I wonder if my strategy for thinking about the most pertinent clinical signs, and listeners, feel free to steal this if you wish for your PACES preparation, but I almost imagined like a whiteboard in my head of these are the clinical signs I found. And the difficulty obviously with PACES is you're going through the examination in a conventional systematic fashion, but the most likely pertinent or most significant findings are going to be towards the end of your examination. As I went through, for example, I felt the pulse and it was AF, I would in my head write AF at the top of the whiteboard with the most pertinent signs going at the top. And then as the signs were sort of trumped going through the examination, those signs would then knock themselves down the whiteboard. And so you end up with the most pertinent signs at the top, but hopefully also picking up the things which you've detected through the course of your examination. As you mentioned, Dan, finding one significant finding, if you neglect to mention a smaller sign elsewhere, that's when you're not getting enough credit for your examination, because if you have seen it and you don't tell anyone, you may as well not have seen it.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is people could have hedged their bets about what they think they might find. So you can have a patient with no signs. There might just be one finding, or there might be 10. But so don't have an expectation about how many you will or you won't find. Or, you might walk out the station and you think, oh my God, I didn't say this tiny sign. We're actually not that fussed about sort of the smaller kind of softer signs. We really want you to get the core signs. So people will get themselves into a right tiz saying that they felt that the apex beat was, half a centimetre to the right, to all the left of where it should be. And actually, probably, unless it's really barn door, we're not going to be bothered. We also remember that we're jobbing consultants, and actually we are also probably not that much better at examination than most people. So if we can't find it, or we think it's a bit borderline, then we won't expect people to do it.
And the only other thing which I put into this domain is not being able to differentiate between similar signs is, for me anyway, something which is not acceptable from listeners. So if you can't tell fine crepitations from coarse crepitations, or if you can't tell a systolic from a diastolic murmur, those are, your absolute basic skills of PACES. And if you're going into your examination and you're still questioning yourself as to whether or not you can do that, I think you need more preparation time.
Yeah, and there's always caveats. So, sometimes it won't be barn door, and we'll then calibrate accordingly. But sometimes, the crackles are so barn door, then you say, well, come on, this is clearly this. But, if you come in and say that someone with hypotonia is hypertonic, for example, then you will not do well.
Listeners, I am delighted to welcome a brand new podcast partner, Scrubs, in all caps, S-C-R-B-S. This company is run by two GPs and they make awesome scrubs. I've been wearing mine for a couple of weeks now and they absolutely strike the balance between being comfortable, functional, and appearing professional at work at a decent price. And they're even more affordable when you use the discount code PACES10 to get 10% off any order. Just head to scrubs.co.uk, S-C-R-B-S. paces10.co.uk and use the code PACES10 for 10% off your order at the checkout. Fantastic, Dan. So now we're going to move on to domain C or skill C, which is clinical communication. And so this is one which is obviously examined in your communication stations, but also in your clinical consultation stations, but importantly, not in your examination stations. So what are the biggest pitfalls you found for candidates failing in this particular domain?
So I'm going to talk about consultation first, which is now the only place where you get your history taking skills tested. So communication encompasses a couple of different things. So one of them is ability to take a systematic and thorough history. And the second part is obviously around your generic communication skills. Do you talk clearly in a way that people can understand, and avoiding jargon and giving correct information? So in consultation, the core things that people do well are keep their history systematic and thorough and go back again to the medical school history taking and do it, because you've got more time to do that now. And I would say that you should try and take your history as if you were just taking a history. So they don't forget things like, smoking, alcohol, drugs, sexual history, travel history, if those things might be relevant to the scenario. They spend some time exploring the presenting complaint and actually delving into it and going down the avenues that they think. And they signpost to the examiner, this person's come in with, anemia. I've been given an anemia result. And so they go, okay, how do I approach this? History of presenting complaint, fine. And then they go, okay, I need to demonstrate that I can say, what are the symptoms of anemia? Chest pain, short of breath, syncope, lethargy, tick. I need to now demonstrate that I'm looking for an underlying cause of the anemia. So I'm going to screen for red flags for malignancy. I'm going to talk about nutritional stuff. So that's how you do it. You work through the problem that you've got, and you signpost to us that you're going down all of the relevant avenues. And if the patient has something in their history that might be relevant, explore that, because that might be relevant. So for the history taking, what people do is they think they don't need to take a full history. They want to get onto the examination and explain the findings. So they jump quickly and then they've missed. And I know in theory we say, you can examine and take a history at the same time, but I've never seen anyone be able to successfully do it. They say, I'm going to just examine you and we'll continue to ask you questions. Then there's like stop-start process. So if you think you can do that, by all means try, but people tend to just not be able to multitask in that way. I think that's the core part for the history. And then the second part is the generic communication skills, which are applicable to both communication and consultation, which is not using jargon. But actually the key thing is around listening and being clear and open and giving, time and allowing patients to communicate back to you as well, not giving a lecture, which sort of overlaps with skill F, managing patient concerns. So I think systematic history, keeping it jargon-free, checking understanding, not giving incorrect information, and stopping and checking that patients are understanding are all core parts of the communication skill.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to go back to something which we discussed briefly in the last episode of the podcast, the memory loss episode, where we discussed about empathy as well, and showing empathy, particularly in the communication stations, but also in the consultation stations, but not falling into the trap of saying, oh, what's your biggest concern? Oh, well, I'm concerned I'm not going to be able to walk in a year's time. Oh, okay. And what did you do for work? Making sure you're being empathetic and really connecting with the patient on a human level, because that's what the exam partly is trying to demonstrate.
It's so easy in an exam to think, I'm in the middle of this bit of my history, I can't be diverted off this, and the actor or the patient throws you something huge and it just gets missed and overlooked so easily. And you have to develop a way of being able to either addressing it then or addressing it and parking it and then coming back to it as well, which is often what people forget.
Absolutely. So moving on to the next skill, our next one is differential diagnosis. Now that's skill D, which is relevant as part of our examination stations, as well as our clinical consultation stations, but not our communication stations. And so this, in my experience, Dan, or the way that I thought about this in my PACES preparation, is you absolutely have to have a list of differential diagnoses for each clinical presentation. So for example, the really big ones, the chronic liver disease, the Parkinsonism, the interstitial lung disease, the systolic murmur, you just absolutely have to have a list of differentials ready to go. And so what have you found have been the pitfalls for candidates in this differential diagnosis domain?
If you get a stat, if you get something you're expecting that fits nicely into a box and you pick up the signs, then you're absolutely right. People need to be able to then just list off, you know, the stuff that's in all those paces books that you'll have spoken about on the podcasts. Surprisingly, people still struggle to do that. Some are excellent at it. But, you know, if you get an aortic stenosis or you get a clear chronic liver disease, as you said, that should just open up your book. You think, hallelujah, I can just list off my diagnosis. And you may be able to order your differentials based on what you would do. So that's one. You may get a problem where, for example, you would, you know, let's say you get a metallic mitral valve. That's grand. You can say, oh, there's a metallic, this is a metallic mitral valve. So then the differential gets divided into one, can you tell us what the problem is? Number two, do you have a reasonable differential for why the patient would have needed a mitral valve, for example? So these are the causes of, you know, mitral regurgitation and mitral stenosis, etc. And then actually more commonly what's happening is people, we know that's what people regurgitate. So actually the vignette is important. So this patient's come with breathlessness. So we then also expect you to have a differential for why would a patient with a mitral valve replacement have come in with breathlessness? And again, you might want to put the things that relate to mitral valve problems first of all, but actually all the usual stuff that relate to breathlessness. And if you're in the cardiology station, you're going to probably say what the cardiac causes of breathlessness are going to be higher up, but you'll also say there's some respiratory causes and other, you know, other things that you'd want to think about. The people who do badly are the ones that can't think on their feet and can't kind of do what you would do on a normal daily life when you're doing a post-take ward round or, you know, what have you, you know, similar lobectomy, you know, diagnose one that there is a lobectomy, then why would the patient have possibly had a lobectomy? Oh, and now they've come in breathless. What are the causes of them coming? So you have to be able to move yourself around on that. So the things that people do wrong, they obviously get the signs wrong and then they can't get the diagnosis right. You can't do anything about that if you've got the signs wrong. You aren't systematic and have a logical diagnosis. You can get the right diagnosis, but then you just can't have any differential. So my PACES station 5 was vitiligo, and it was so obviously vitiligo that I didn't really know what else to say. But you have to kind of have some, you can say this is pathognomonic vitiligo and the exams will be fine, you've got the diagnosis, but they asked me what would be a differential. So the differential is for anything with hypopigmented skin lesions, and you don't have to have a long list. You know, I think I said something like pityriasis, versicolor, and some kind of scarring condition. And you just need to show awareness that you can problem solve. So rigid thinking, not being able to get off, or just completely going wrong. And I think once you start doing that, because you can't think forward. So again, the patient who had the lobectomy, why would this young man have had a lobectomy? He'd had it because of malignancy. Cystic fibrosis, ILD, all of these things came up. And that just immediately people had lost the plot. So that's why practicing going around with your friends and, you know, challenging each other, you know, being a bit mean to each other and asking them is a really helpful way of practicing, because I think the only way you can prepare for this, particularly if you get a slightly non-standard set of signs that you can't quite put together, and neurology is core for that, is vital. So to get the satisfactory, you have to get the correct diagnosis. That doesn't mean if the patient has a rare genetic condition, we would expect you to know the name of the genetic, but you'd have to say something that sort of would include that, like, you know, genetic cause, and a sensible list of differentials. And I think for consultation, it's the same, but you get the additional benefit of having the history that can really make a big difference into your differential. The other thing is, you know, saying the really rare stuff at the top. What we would generally want is for people to tell us what's the most likely differential here. What we don't want to hear is what's the most serious problem that you can exclude here, because this is, we don't want people to be practicing. That will really get me going. If you start saying, well, I need to exclude a subarachnoid hemorrhage, and it's clearly not that, I'm fine for you to say that, but you need to tell me, well, I think this is a migraine because it's hemicranial headache. Differentials would be, you know, tension headache, you know, da, 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 da. I think subarachnoid is unlikely. It's about being sensible, doing what you do, and being rational in giving your differential.
Yeah, I mean, my advice from that perspective in terms of thinking on your feet is having a surgical sieve readily available and having the etiologies of certain presentations through. And that can be something which you don't even need to see a patient for, but you could just meet with your friends and say, okay, these are the findings. What are the potential differential diagnoses going through a systematic surgical sieve rather than rote learning a list depending on the presentation? And so moving on to clinical judgment, this is now, what letter are we on now? Clinical judgment is E. And so this, I think, is in every single station, isn't it?
Yeah, this is in every one.
In every single station, you'll be assessed on your clinical judgment. And so, I mean, the brief thoughts that I thought about clinical judgment is, does this equivocate a bit to the investigations and management part of the discussion, Dan? Is that more or less it?
In general, yes, particularly for the physical examination and the consultation stations. It's broadly related to what you're going to do now, how you're going to investigate and manage with the patient in a sensible way. In the communication skill stations, it's about demonstrating your knowledge of whatever the clinical ethical issues are that relate to that communication. So obviously we don't have time to question you now. So if you don't kind of highlight and signpost in the communication skills, the kind of key areas and knowledge, then we don't have a chance to say, actually, can you just clarify what you meant by when you said to the patient there? So yeah, for physical examination encounters, it's all about the sensible investigation and management. And it's a bit like differential. It's about being really systematic and just working your way through in a logical fashion. What we don't really want to hear is, I'm going to do a full blood count checking for anemia and infection, and then I'm going to do a renal profile to look for this. You're just wasting your time. We know what you want to do those for generally. You can tell us, but if we want to get you to the goodies, we'll move you on. You know, start with bedside further history and examination, bedside observations, what blood tests you want to do. And don't say, oh, we'll do a full blood count and a CRP and then a nerve conduction study, because actually there's still a lot of blood tests you'd want to do. So it's just about gently taking yourself through, but doing it quickly enough that you can get to the stuff. So there is a problem that if in the physical examination you fail, you get unsatisfactory on physical signs, we're not allowed to give you more than a borderline on differential diagnosis or clinical judgment, because if you've not got the signs but you've guessed the right management, there's a bit of a linked marking there. In consultation, again, it's about putting it together, doing something sensible. And that one of the things people commonly like to do is admit people to hospital when they could be ambulated. So think about ambulatory care, think about, you know, other ways of managing people apart from admitting everyone into hospital. And then for communication, as I say, it's really around just flagging, making sure the clinical information that you give in the scenario that you're asked to give is accurate and not kind of crazy out there, that you're not telling the patient something that's completely wrong. And then where possible, demonstrating through the communication that you're using whatever ethical clinical principles are there and not doing anything too rogue.
Yeah, absolutely. And the only small note I made on this one is basically, is the plan safe for this particular patient if they were presented on the acute take?
Yeah, and it has to obviously be clinically right for the things. And it's about having the core things in there. And you said earlier around the kind of common presentations in PACES. And so, again, the level of knowledge, the detail of knowledge required for this in most cases is not high. If you've got something straightforward, like you've got a chest pain or an aortic stenosis in consultation or examination, then you're going to need to know the basics of that quite well. If you've got a rare presentation, let's say, I don't know, polymyalgia rheumatica is a scenario we've run, which works quite well. The level of detail you'd need to know in the investigation and management is just going to be limited to the kind of the bloods that you do, the clinical diagnosis, and then trialing some steroids and seeing how they get on. We wouldn't expect kind of more detailed knowledge than that. And that's what we do when we calibrate, you know, is it the basics of this scenario that they need to know? Is there something more complicated? And then, yeah, as you say, if there's a key element in there that's related to safety or a key piece of clinical knowledge, then, you know, if it's a pregnant patient with, you know, something and there's a drug that they really can't take that we would expect you to know, we would expect you to kind of demonstrate that kind of thing.
Fantastic. So moving on to our next domain, we're moving on to managing patient concerns. And it's one of the ones where it's only 10% of the mark, but I think this is skill F. And so this is something which is found in the communication stations only.
And consultation. So this is one where it's you see a surprising number of people who've done well in everything else and then they drop in this skill because it gets overlooked and people think they can do it. So I think it's such an important thing to do properly and not just kind of give lip service to, because you see happening 2 minute warning, the candidate goes, do you have any concerns? Or we tell the surrogates and the patients and whoever's doing that in the communication consultation, if the candidate hasn't asked you, you must put your concern in there, because we want to give, even if they don't ask it, we want to give them a chance to demonstrate that they can. So I think the key things that people do really well is they ask the concerns and the worries and what they want to get out of the consultation up front. Many people do that right at the beginning and then they park them. Some of them do it early on. The people who struggle the most are the ones who leave it right to the end and don't ask until they've finished everything else. So I think not asking or not exploring the concerns is a surefire way to be in trouble. Glossing over them, we mentioned, I think. So, you know, the classic thing is, you know, the surrogate knows the time is lapsing and they want to give you the time and you're still taking the history. So the surrogate goes, I'm really worried about my job. And the candidate goes, are you a smoker? And that happens. I can't tell you how much that happens. Or there's a real obvious cue coming, you know, that the surrogates, particularly in the community, they're really good at dropping stuff in and people just don't look. So you don't have to address it then, but even just saying, oh, God, that's a real, really difficult worry. I just need to finish these questions and I'll ask you about it. We'll talk about it. If I don't bring it up again, can you remind me? Because I really want to make sure we've addressed that. So glossing over them and then never coming back. The thing that really gets me going is in the consultation is people think their job is to just explain the diagnosis and the plan to the patient, which is obviously a core part of the consultation station. But many candidates think that that means they've addressed their concerns. So actually the concern will be around, you know, being deformed forever from the rheumatoid arthritis, not being able to go back to work. Can they drive again? And the candidate thinks, I think you've got rheumatoid arthritis. This is an inflammatory condition. And I think we need to do some tests. I'm hopeful that we can give you some treatment and that will be helpful. We want to do X, Y, and Z. Any questions? And they think they've addressed the concerns. They haven't. They've done what their agenda is of thinking they need to explain the management plan and the diagnosis. And that happens all the time. So you've really got to make sure that you have explored and delved in for the concerns, not just thinking that you've done your bit and lectured the patient on what your plan is, which makes you feel happy. That's such a common thing. And empathy, we mentioned earlier, it's not hard. And actually, I think, you know, most people do it okay, but you've got to have some kind of empathetic responses, you know, and even if it's just saying, you know, you're having a really shit time of it at the moment. Clearly, this is really awful for you. We need to kind of try and do something to help you. It doesn't take much to show some empathy, particularly in PACES. The standard of empathy you need to show is quite limited. You just need to do it. And then the other things are superficially addressing the concerns and not really checking the patient's happy or that feels that their concern is addressed. And then summarizing and checking understanding, particularly if you've run out, if you've got time at the end and you're thinking, well, there's 3 minutes left. Again, you probably have missed something, but actually you can summarize, you can ask the patient to summarize. And if it's in communication, it's often around negotiating a management plan. And often the candidate will sort of summarize their plan and assume that the patient has agreed to it, and actually the patient may not have fully agreed to it. So it's about making sure if you're negotiating a plan that you really have negotiated a plan, and it's not that you've told the patient what you think and they've kind of nodded okay and they've assumed. So it's not hard to do this. This is one of the easiest bits, because it's just about being kind, it's about being human, and it's about listening, giving patients a chance to talk and then responding in a human way. But it can be so easily overlooked when there's all the other pressing stuff that people need to demonstrate.
Yeah, absolutely. And just going back to the thing you were mentioning, for in that example you used of the rheumatoid arthritis concerns, there's no reason that you can't tie their concerns into your explanation of the management plan. You know, if they've told you their concern is they're not going to work again or they can't go back to their job as a typing secretary, you can say, well, We can ask a rheumatologist to see you and they can consider starting some treatment. And some people tend to respond quite well to treatment and there is a possibility you could go back to work. Is that the type of response that you wanted? And there's no reason you can't tie that in. But as you say, being direct in addressing their concerns and checking they're happy with it is going to be really important with making sure you are managing the concerns of the patient.
Yeah. And the best people do exactly what you've said. They seamlessly integrate it all together. They can kind of keep it structured, but also be malleable and adapt their consultation style to do it. They proactively think of things that people might worry about. And those are all really good. And everyone would have seen people who can just do that, and they have it's almost natural gift. And it's about how can you do that yourself if you're not the person who has a natural gift of just being able to do this without thinking.
And I think the other thing, which is an example which I've heard on the grapevine, is when reacting to a concern, which is opposed in a sort of semi-aggressive way. So the example I'm thinking of is a gentleman who wanted to, as part of a communication station, wanted to sue his employer for the effect it had had on his health. And he said, I want you to give me all my hospital notes right now. And I want to sue my employer, and you've got to help me do that. And the initial impression from the person I was speaking to was, oh, wow, this is that's quite upfront and sort of almost aggressive about it. But actually, when you say, well, of course, you're entitled to all of your notes, but it's got to go through the proper process. You can request them, and we'll be able to provide them to you through the necessary channels. You immediately dissipate the aggression, and it's almost just taking a step back to react to the initial sort of shock of it and then provide the solution the patient wants.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, it's not just about information giving about how they can help the actual concern, but actually saying, you know, acknowledging God, that sounds quite a big step to take. This must be really, you know, really have affected you, you know, and acknowledging it. And as you say, that will, the surrogate or the patient will often just then melt away if you do that, because they'll feel validated. And
absolutely. And so moving on to the final domain, managing patient welfare. This is one of the ones which is throughout every single one, I think, isn't it? Because, you know, you'd be hard pushed not to manage a patient's welfare in any situation. And so this is really, or what it should be, is it should be a gimme, really. You should be managing the patient's welfare well at all times. Dan, the first question I had from this perspective is hurting the patient during a station, is potentially hurting a patient, an instant fail?
No, it's not. So skill G, the pass mark is 28 out of 32. So you have to get almost full marks because it's meant to be. And almost everyone does. It's very unusual for someone to get marked down on skill B. It has to be something fairly significant for you to kind of get marked down. If you hurt a patient by accident and you respond appropriately and you say, I'm really sorry, what can I do to help? Then no, nothing will happen. If you've done that because you were doing something really stupid, like you were looking, you know, at their feet and prodding their abdomen like you were trying to dig into the earth, and then you did it, some examiners might find that would be a reason, because you could have prevented it easily. But in general, you know, if you do something a bit silly and accidentally and you're apologetic and you fix it immediately and you don't do it again, you will be fine. The reasons that people get marked down on this are in kind of communication, being very rude, dismissing people's concerns, you know, very, very strongly, saying something really unsafe. So part of management that would be a real patient, not just getting something wrong, but there was something, you know, really that would be a patient safety issue that would be very unsafe and could lead to significant harm. And in examination, it's usually around being rough, causing them pain. So, you know, examining the abdomen whilst looking down is fine, and the patient goes, oh, that's a bit sore. And instead of going, oh, I'm so sorry, and going much more gently, they press on and continue to cause the patient discomfort. And it doesn't happen very often, but it does happen occasionally. And, you know, using the neuro tip and doing it really aggressively so that the patient says, ow, okay, apologize. But then again, going back and continuing to do that kind of thing. So you really have to do something that is affecting the patient's welfare or safety or dignity to get scored down on this. But it does happen occasionally.
Well, that's going to hopefully be a rarity. You know, you'd be really hard pushed to not manage a patient's welfare well with regard to, you know, getting the necessary marks to pass that domain. But Dan, we've come to the end of assessing every single one of the marking domains. Were there any final thoughts you had, particularly on PACE's pitfalls and how our listeners can best avoid these?
I think it's all just about going back to basics, really. So in your histories and examinations, it's about practice, be really systematic, don't ignore history and think it's a skill that doesn't need to be tested. Consultation, really select what physical examination and make sure you can do them thoroughly. Practice, putting it all together with your friends. So don't revise for PACES by yourself from a book. You need to go with a group of people with varying abilities so you can learn from other people and practice talking about it. And don't don't forget patient concerns and kind of worries and empathy in the exam as well. But I think if you practice in a systematic and you examine lots of patients and practice the talking elements, you know, there should be no reason that you can't pass. The standard is high, but actually when you really go into it, the standard of knowledge really is at the level of an IMT kind of 2 progressing to IMT 3. So we're not expecting kind of weird, wonderful, rare stuff. It's just about the core stuff you would see on the medical take, the top presentations, the common conditions, and then the rare presentations that you shouldn't miss if they present on your medical take or in your clinic.
Absolutely fantastic. Well, I think that brings us to the end of this week's episode. And that only leaves us to say a huge thank you again to Dr. Dan Firmage, consultant geriatrician, PACES examiner, IMT TPD extraordinaire, all-round nice guy. Dan, thank you so much for joining us again on the podcast.
No problem, Sam. You probably need to tone down your introductions to be more realistic. Thanks a lot.
Dan, it's been an absolute pleasure. But listeners, that is just about all the time we've got for this week's show. Please don't forget to like, follow, subscribe, leave a review to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We love to hear from you. Give us a shout out on our Twitter. That's at Prepaces Podcast. And if you really want to go above and beyond and support the show, you can do that at buymeacoffee.com/Prepaces Podcast. But for now, we're just about out of time. Thank you so much for listening. I've been Dr. Sam Williams, and we will see you next time on the Prepaces Podcast.